Five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski.
The whole thing is very mysterious, but this is what I know.
Authorities say a menacing letter received yesterday by a Vallejo newspaper was not sent by the infamous Zodiac Killer. Betsy Gebhardt has details.
That Area 51, the secret Air Force base in Nevada, actually exists.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
Welcome back to the House of Mystery. I'm your host today, Al Warren, and joining me, co-hosting, is Stephen David Lampley, our true crime commentator. Hey, Stephen, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. Welcome, everyone.
Yeah, another day. How's your, now, the true crime commentary? So you've got, you've extended that to, it's about a half hour long now, and there's kind of, you're kind of covering a whole case now, aren't you?
I am. One of the true crime commentary, of course, we had a 10-minute segment. We had to extend it out over several commentaries. Now we're able to take one subject and do the full treatment on it in one show, which is pretty cool. And plus, we're doing a case review on an unsolved murder or suspicious missing person as well every week.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Okay, now speaking of unsolved cases, we've got a doozy. And everyone that listens knows that we have a lot from the 60s, so all the different assassinations and all the different things that happened back then in the good old days. So we have another great guest who's done a lot of research, and I caught on to him by one of his books, Dr. Mary's Monkey. Now, this is quite a case. We get into... how the unsolved murder of a doctor, a secret laboratory in New Orleans, and cancer-causing monkey viruses are linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK assassination, and the emerging global epidemics. So it's quite a mouthful here, but this is quite a book. So welcome to the show, Edward T. Haslam.
Thank you very much, Alan.
So, Edward, let's get into the book. Tell us and tell the listeners kind of what the book is focused on. What's it about?
Well, the book is first and foremost a cold case investigation into the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman that happened in July of 1964. And it's what I call the hottest cold case in America. And when you see the crime scene photos, you'll understand why I say that. It is a unsolved murder, but it was also not properly investigated, and they shut down the investigation. Now, if you the big point in this murder is this woman's right arm and rib cage were disintegrated by fire. She was found at home in her apartment. She was naked. She had been stabbed 7 or 8 times, and her body had been set on fire in her bed. But they never told the public. I mean, this was a front page murder story for 2 weeks, above the full front page. They never told the public that her right arm was missing. Now, this is like if you're talking about the Nicole Simpson, O.J. Simpson murder trial, this is like not mentioning that Nicole's throat was cut. I mean, it's the main forensic fact in the case, and it was not told to the public. Now, the question is why not? You know, and as we get into this story, I mean, who was this woman? What was she working on? Who did she work for? You know, and all this other stuff, you realize that this one murder is at the center of all of this other stuff involving these huge public health issues and the huge political issues, and the whole story becomes like an onion. You're peeling it off layer after layer, and it becomes an octopus. I mean, it's a very complex story with lots of moving parts, but it all starts with looking into the death of this one woman who was a friend of my family's. I actually sat on her lap as a child. And so I'll tell you about her and tell you about what we know about her murder and all that.
Is that what led you into this story, actually, in writing the book, was your connection with her?
Well, it was like this story came to me. I didn't go to it. I mean, I'm from New Orleans, okay, and this happens in New Orleans. And the woman who was murdered was a professor of orthopedic surgery at Tulane Medical School. Well, my father was also a professor of orthopedic surgery at Tulane Medical School. My father and this woman were professional colleagues and very good friends, and she would occasionally come out to the house, which is how I wound up sitting on her lap, okay? But the point is, when this woman died, when she was murdered, it was like one of my father's best friends, so it was big news in our family. I was a 13-year-old kid at the time. But one of the things that happens in a lot of cities, but New Orleans is a particularly gossipy city, and what happens is doctors talk to their wives and wives talk to their children, and I started hearing things about this murder that the public didn't know. And I was told it was shut down. The investigation was shut down from above. And when, at one point in time, I tried to get a hold of the police file on the murder, and the guy who offered to get it for me, you know, screamed at me and said, "What are you doing? You almost got me fired!" You know, there was a lot of heat on this case. And when you start to get into woman and what were the levels of connections, you'll start to realize why this case was. I mean, I have a memo from J. Edgar Hoover dated 10 days after her murder, after Mary Sherman's murder, telling his agents not to investigate the case.
Ooh.
Okay?
Yeah. Wow. So for the audience, let's get them up to speed on understanding here. So what was she doing that created this scenario where she ends up being murdered in her house, in her apartment? And also, let's talk about the murder itself, how she was found.
Okay. Well, first of all, one of the things that had been known about her, at least talked about for a long time. But back in the 1960s, Jim Garrison did an interview in Playboy magazine where he made the claim that his investigators had discovered that this woman had been doing some kind of secret cancer research with David Ferry, who was his primary suspect in the JFK assassination. And most of the JFK assassination researchers I talked to just read through that comment because they didn't know who Mary Sherman was. They figured if she was connected with David Ferry, she's probably some loon doctor too, okay?
Yeah.
Mary Sherman was from the University of Chicago, okay?
Yeah.
That's the place that developed nuclear power. Amongst her personal friends and colleagues up there, people like Enrico Fermi, who filled out the periodic table, and he and Zeiler developed the bomb, okay? And he did the first sustained nuclear reaction. Now, what Mary Sherman was published in the medical journals in two and three areas, actually. One was radiation. She was a world-class expert in radiation. She was a world-class expert in cancer, and, of course, she was an orthopedic surgeon. She was, in fact, the chair of the pathology committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, which made her one of the highest ranked in medicine at the time. So if you understand that Mary Sherman is a heavy hitter and a world-class medical doctor, the question is, what is somebody with those kind of credentials doing in an underground medical laboratory with a political lunatic like David Ferry? So that is what the puzzle is that needs to be solved. Now, when Mary Sherman's body, a neighbor smelled some smoke and called the police, not the fire department, the police. And the police came and found the door to her apartment ajar. The apartment was full of smoke. Nobody even reported seeing a flame, though. Okay? And they called the fire department. The fire department went in and found a smoldering mattress and this dead body on the floor. Okay, and the body probably rolled off the mattress when they removed the mattress from the apartment. The body was naked. Okay? It was upside down in the bed, meaning the feet were pointing towards the headboard in that direction. And it had been stabbed 7 or 8 times. There's some ambiguity in there. The right arm, entire right arm and rib cage from the down to the hip bone, was disintegrated by heat. I mean, just gone. The organs, the cops on the scene so they could stand there and see the organs. Inside of her body. But immediately next to that, her hair was not burned, okay? And the hair on her skin was not burned. Now, we've all burned hair around a stove at some point in time because it's the easiest thing on the body to burn. And bones technically don't even burn. Even in cremations, they just dehydrate them. And when they're finished burning off the soft tissue, they grind up the bones and hand you the bone dust and say, here are the remains. So, it takes thousands of degrees of temperature to burn a bone, all right? So, and in fact, I interviewed a guy who used to work for the military. One of the things he did was he would go to jet crash sites and pull the remains of the pilots out of the thing. He said, I've never seen bones disappear. He said, the heat, Jet A burns at like 5,000 degrees. He said the heat was so hot it would burn the aluminum off the fuselage, but the bones were still there, okay? So what burned off her arm and ribcage? The toaster? I mean, you look around the apartment. Is there anything in the apartment that could possibly do that? And then you look at the crime scene photos. By the way, listeners want to see these while they're listening to this interview. You can, if you have access to the Internet, which most people do, you can just go to my website, which is drmarysmonkey.com, but spell out doctor. And or you can just Google my name, Haslam, H-A-S-L-A-M, and the word monkey, and it'll pull up the same website. But at the top of that page, top of the landing page, is a link there about hottest cold case, and that will take you to the crime scene photos so you can see what we're talking about. Now, the point is, once you, and it took me a long time to get to this thinking, I'm explaining it pretty quickly here, but once you realize that there's nothing in her apartment that could possibly do the damage to her body, you are left with the inescapable conclusion that whatever happened to her happened somewhere else, and they brought her body back, and they faked the murder scene. Now, to me, the importance of this from a forensic point of view is the real crime scene was never investigated. The only thing that was investigated was her apartment, which was where they dropped the body. Okay, and they set fire, this mattress fire, to create some kind of plausible explanation for the burns on her body, but they never told the public that her arm was missing. Or if they never, I mean, this is, you know, again, like the Nicole Simpson thing, without mentioning her throat got cut. It's the main fact in the case. Now, why didn't they want the public to know that? I think the reason is because they didn't want people going around uptown New Orleans looking for a multi-million volt electrical machine that could have burned off her arm. Because if you show these photos to somebody that's a, like, does safety work for an electrical utility, he'll say, yeah, that's an arc flash burn. We get a couple of them a year. They destroy people. All right? It's a high voltage burn. And there's nothing that's high voltage in her apartment. Now, the other thing from a forensic point of view, and I have the autopsy in the back of the book, is the actual cause of death was a precise stab wound to the heart, about a quarter inch wide, okay, that right between the fifth and sixth ribs, it goes straight into the heart, and there's 1,200 cc's of blood in the pericardium sac. Next to that, you know, the liver's like right next to the heart, okay? There's a stab wound in the liver, and it does not bleed. There is no hemorrhage. Now, here's the big point. You bleed when you're alive, and you don't bleed when you're dead. So those two stab wounds, the one to the heart and the one to the liver, did not happen at the same time. So what you've got is you've got two fires, the one that burned off her arm and the mattress fire, and you've got two sets of stab wounds, the one that killed her and the post-mortem stab wounds that were done in her apartment. And we know they were done in her apartment because somebody piled a bunch of neatly folded underwear that they pulled out of a drawer on top of her as fuel for the fire, and they stabbed her through the underwear, because when they unfolded the underwear, they saw all the V-cuts. So they know those post-mortem wounds were done in the apartment. Okay? So okay, that's the basic forensic puzzle.
I have a couple of questions, and I ask this question mainly for our listeners. Now, this was obviously a very high security of a big deal, a big operation going on, supposedly involving a lot of high-profile folks. But my question is, in my opinion, of course I wasn't there, but in looking at the crime scene photos and talking to you prior to the show today, it appears to me that this operation was very massive, but they were somewhat sloppy acting in haste to dispose of her body because they weren't very thorough with making sure that she was disposed of. Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, it's a great observation, and I do think they were operating in haste. What happened was she was at another facility where they had a very powerful piece of electronic equipment known as a linear particle accelerator. And that was a secret laboratory for doing work for the United States government. And I'll talk about how we know that and all that in a minute. But the point is, they wound up with this world-famous doctor electrocuted in a facility that the government didn't even want to admit existed. And it was on federal property. Okay? They didn't want the attention called to that laboratory, because somebody would say, wow, what is this place? What are y'all doing in here? And why are you doing that? And what were they doing? They were using radiation to mutate monkey viruses. Oh, why are you doing that? Because we just mass inoculated the entire American population with a polio vaccine that was contaminated with cancer-causing monkey viruses, and we got a problem.
Okay. Yeah. One more question. I'll hush for a while. Let Alan take over.
Oh, no. You
mentioned that, of course, I saw the crime scene photos just prior. Of course, you showed me how to go to them. Prior to the show, and I looked at them, and when we discussed them for a bit, what actually killed her? Was it the stabbing to the heart or the electrocution?
It was the stab wound to the heart. Now, here's how it goes. This is the sequence. When I finally found somebody that knew about the detail of the facility, one of the things that he told me that was that there was a steel wall in the facility that had a cable that was run to the ground. Now, this was to protect the operators from the radiation, okay? Normally, when you have an electrocution of this level, the electricity goes down the body and blows the feet off. Here, her body, I mean, her feet are fine. You can see she's laying on the gurney. Her feet are fine, okay? What was happened was she grabbed something with her right hand, and she was standing in front of this steel wall. So the electricity entered her hand, went up her arm, and through her rib cage, and out her back into the steel wall, and blew it out like a fuse. Okay? And then she collapsed. Now, I've talked to doctors, and I've got a lot of help on this. I talked to doctors who had experience with these types of electrocutions, and they say, if this is her right hand, and it goes out her right shoulder. That did not cross her heart. Okay, he said, if the electricity does not, path of electricity does not cross the heart, a lot of times the electrocution does not kill the person. The heart continues to beat. Okay, so what we had here was she was maimed, probably would not have survived, certainly wouldn't want to wake up to discover that half, a quarter of her body is missing, you know, but her heart is still beating. So somebody with her, probably with medical knowledge, just because of the precision of the way these cuts were done, slipped a surgical-style instrument in between her fifth and sixth ribs and cut a hole directly in the center of her heart, and the blood came out and she died. That is what the autopsy findings about the cause of death.
Well, why do you think they had such an elaborate murder plan? Like, why not just shoot her or something like that? Like, why was it so complex?
Well, that's a great question, because if, I mean, a lot of people have said to me, oh, they killed her because they wanted to shut her up. And I said, well, there's a lot of easier ways to kill people, you know, to shut them up. You know, you can shoot them or stab them or poison them or just knock them on the head with something. This was like an industrial accident, but the question is whether the accident was accidental or not. And when you start to realize who this woman was and who she worked for and what she was involved in, then you start to realize that this looks like sabotage. And she might not even have been the target, but what was the target was whoever they were after, whoever was running this equipment. And so, you know, as I look at it, I mean, she walks into this facility, turns on the machine and grabs the handle to connect connect or disconnect the electricity, that basic switch. And somebody has tampered with the wiring so that the electricity that's running down the copper wire in the middle now starts coming back on the steel casing to the switch itself. And she gets fried. Now, it could have been somebody else. This guy she works for, this is really interesting. This guy she works for is called Dr. Oshner, all right? Alton Oshner. Alton Oshner, I've got his FBI file. He was doing secret assignments for the U.S. military all the way back to World War II. Okay? He was a spook doctor. They would even fly him around in Air Force fighter jets so that they could get him to Central America in a couple of hours and stuff when they needed to. Oshner, again, I have his FBI file. He was cleared for a sensitive position in 1959 by J. Edgar Hoover himself, okay? Hoover's signature is on this document clearing a sensitive position. I mean, that gives you a red passport. You're unquestionable at that point in time. You're doing something at the highest level of sensitivity and security for the United States government. Okay? So who was Ochsner? And you get into the background. Well, Ochsner, first of all, is founder of the Ochsner Clinic in New Orleans, this great big clinic. But he is famous for a couple other reasons. One is he was president of the American Cancer Society. Okay? And he's one of the guys, a handful of them, who went to the federal government and said, you guys got to put warnings on cigarette packets because this stuff is causing cancer. All right? So Ochsner was a very high-level, thoroughly connected guy, president of the American Cancer Society at one point, where he sat on the board of directors with Wild Bill Donovan, the founder of the CIA. Okay. The other thing about Ochsner that's really interesting is that Ochsner was involved in the polio vaccine. And he was one of the was the major stockholder of Cutter Laboratories, which was one of the six laboratories producing the polio vaccine in the 1950s. And one of the things that happens is, you know, this was Jonas Salk was the original polio vaccine. And in 1955, they're getting ready to release this thing, and the Salk vaccine. And the Polio Society, March of Dimes people, call a press conference up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And they have a doctor up there who's been doing the, Dr. Francis, who's been doing these tests. That's what they call them when they take a vaccine that's not been approved or authorized and inject it into children to see what happens. They injected about 1,700 kids, and they declared publicly in front of the media that the polio vaccine was safe and effective and it works and everybody can roll up their sleeves and get ready for their injection because this was a syringe-delivered vaccine. And then they handed the vaccine they had already told the public was coming. They handed it to a woman by the name of Bernice Eddy, who was the vaccine safety tester for the United States government, and said, here, approve this. Now, the little secret to this whole thing that nobody seems to know is that the polio vaccine was grown on monkey kidney cells. Okay? Mm-hmm. And when they quote, took out the vaccine, they got all of the other viruses that were in the monkey kidney cells. And this is true of both the Salk and Sabin vaccines, which I'll talk about more in a little bit. So what happens here is Bernice goes back to her laboratory and injects the vaccine into her monkeys, and she gets back dead and crippled monkeys. And she said, guys, this thing is not ready to be released. She said, I don't know what the problem is, but here are the photos. You know, these monkeys are sick because of the vaccine. All right? She says, the good news is it's only from one lab. The problem is only from this batch from Cutter Laboratories. Well, Alton Ochsner, Mary Sherman's boss, because she works at the Ochsner Clinic. She runs a cancer lab at the Ochsner Clinic, okay? Yeah. And her boss is the president of the American Cancer Society, right? And they say the problem is with the batch of polio vaccine from Cutter Laboratories, and we need you to withdraw your vaccine. Well, Ochsner said, I'm not doing that. I've known Jonas Salk for 20 years. This thing has been thoroughly tested. I've been watching it all along the way. We have set this up according to specs, blah, blah, blah. He said, I am so sure that this vaccine is safe that I'm going to prove it to you. And he calls the faculty of Tulane Medical School together in the amphitheater. Now, Mary Sherman and my father are both on the faculty. They're in the room, okay? And he said, there's a controversy about the polio vaccine. And I want you to know that I'm not asking you to do anything I wouldn't do myself. Here are my two grandkids, and I'm going to inject them right here, right now. Which he does. And he tells everybody, see, it's safe. Go home. Get your kids vaccinated. Well, in about 48 hours, those two kids are in the hospital, and one of them dies from the polio vaccine. The other one gets polio. Okay? Oshner wound up killing his own grandkids because he wouldn't listen to the safety woman at the National Institutes of Health who said there's a problem with this vaccine. Okay? That is a very direct personal contact between Oshner and the polio vaccine. And remember, he's president of the American Cancer Society. So he's got one foot in polio and one foot in cancer. So 2 years later, when a researcher at the National Cancer Institute by the name of Sarah Stewart and her research partner, Bernice Eddy, the same woman I was just talking about, the vaccine safety, they discover a cancer-causing virus that they name polyoma. And then they realize that this, people start getting electron microscopes and stuff because a lot of research money starts flowing once they make this discovery. They discover that polyoma's original host was the rhesus monkey, formerly known as the Asian macaque, but it's a rhesus monkey. Now, here's the big point. It was the rhesus monkey's kidneys that they used to grow the polio vaccine. And the cancer-causing virus, which they renamed, they called it SV40, used to be called polyoma. Poly meaning many, oma meaning tumors, right? So this one virus caused multiple types of cancers in multiple animals. That's why they named it polyoma. They find it in the polio vaccine. So by 1959, they know there were 200 million doses of the polio vaccine made. By the time they figure out this problem, they have already released 100 million doses, and they still have another 100 million doses on the shelf. And they said, well, we can't pull the polio vaccine off the shelf. Everybody's going, no, want to know why. You know, and we're not about to tell them because it had a cancer-causing virus in it. I mean, they'll lynch us, and they'll never get another vaccine again in their life, and it will destroy modern medicine. We can't do this. This is now a national security secret at the highest levels of the land, and you guys better get really busy finding a solution. Well, how do you find a solution? You make an anti-cancer vaccine. Now, when I came out with this story originally in 1995, an earlier version of the book, people were still saying, but Ed, viruses can't cause cancer. You know, I learned about that in the school in the 60s, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, it's now 2018, and the farmers are out marketing Gardasil to prevent a cancer-causing virus from causing cervical cancer and other kind of cancers. It actually causes quite a few. It's a polyoma virus. So the point is this. I mean, they can't market a vaccine to stop a cancer-causing virus and say there are no cancer-causing viruses at the same time. They've painted themselves into a corner, okay? So we now know there are cancer-causing viruses. And, in fact, I went back and I found a copy of Time magazine that was dated, I think, July of 1959, where the cover article, maybe it was 57, but it's the late 50s, the cover article, it's in my book, the cover article says the new war on cancer through virus research and chemotherapy. And in that article, there's a photograph of these two women I was just talking about, Bernice Eddy and Sarah Stewart. They're both MD, PhDs. And they say in the article that they believe there's the possibility that we can develop a vaccine to stop the cancer-causing virus. Okay? So how do you do that? You know? And, well, going back to the polio vaccine, you know, there was Salk and Sabin. Well, it turns out there were three flavors of polio. Three strains. I'm just going to call them heavy, medium, and light. Right? And Salk said, you know, the only one that really kills and cripples is heavy. So that's the only one you need to stop. The other ones you can ignore. All right? And so he says, what you do is you take it and you drown it in formaldehyde. And now the virus is dead and it can't reproduce. And then you inject your children with this dead virus. And the immune system says, hey, this is weird. This doesn't belong here. Let's get an immune response to it. Okay? So the problem was with the cutter batch was the drowning technique didn't work. Okay? So Jonas Salk, who's got the greatest PR people in the world, had his vaccine pulled off the market 2 weeks after it was released. The head of the National Institutes of Health got sacked. The Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, who is Ovetta Hobby, she was the first woman on the American cabinet, and her husband was the governor of Texas, you know, Hobby Airport and all that stuff, okay? She gets sacked, okay? Most of the management over there gets sacked over the polio vaccine. And then, who's president? Dwight. And he turns to his vice president, who's Nixon? And he said, Dick, you got to get this polio thing back on track. Rebuild the National Institute of Health and find a solution because we have promised the American people they're going to have a polio vaccine. So after a couple of months, there's this other guy who was a competitor of Salk. His name's Sabin, Albert Sabin. Sabin said, well, you remember about the heavy, medium, light? He said, you don't have to mess with the heavy. That's dangerous, man. You go polio light because all that does is give you flu-like symptoms, if anything. And your body develops an immune response that will fight off heavy if it ever shows up. Okay? So they switch strategies, and Albert Sabin's vaccine, which was originally in a syringe and later in a sugar cube, okay, winds up being the vaccine that everybody got, okay, that the 200 million doses. But they were both grown on rhesus monkey kidney cells, and about 198 million, according to the Boston Globe, 198 million doses of this stuff was contaminated with SV40. Simian is a scientific word for monkey. All right, so simian virus number 40 means monkey virus number 40, which meant before they found this virus, they found 39 other monkey viruses that were in those kidneys. Okay?
Yeah.
And dozens of them were in the polio vaccine. So, you know, I mean, once they realized they had already mass inoculated the children of America. And when I read this, you know, I mean, I'm running around with my hair on fire trying to figure out what it is I'm reading. And I said, if this, Bernice Eddy, goes to the Cancer Society to tell them this has happened, and she gets sacked for doing it. They take away her lab. They put her under a gag order. They don't let her go to meetings anymore. Okay? There's even congressional hearings about why they're doing this to this woman. Okay? And I said, she's risking her career, if not her life, to warn us of an epidemic. Did this epidemic ever happen? Okay, well, I got two questions on that. Number one is, you know anybody with cancer?
Yeah.
You know, everybody's got somebody in their friend or family circle with cancer. Why? Because cancer, there's an epidemic of cancer out there nowadays. And I went to the medical library, and I went and got together with the librarian, and I said, I need to know the statistics on cancer, particularly after the polio vaccines. Okay? And she brought back, Nixon did a, it's an interesting story, Nixon did the war on cancer, all right? That was his opening act when he became president. And he financed these, this gathering of, and publishing of these statistics for 16 years, right? Now, the promise was, we're going to cut cancer in half. No, 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 no. There was an explosion of soft tissue cancers, and it's very obvious in the statistics, which are published on about page 200 or so, 210 of my book, and the actual hard data from the National Cancer Institute is in the appendix in the back, right? And so what you've got is you've got four cancers, breast, prostate, and those are both reproductive organs, all right, soft tissues, melanoma, which is skin, and lymphoma, which is the drainage system of the body. Those four, and in fact, I should have made it five, but it's a technical reason I didn't. The fifth one was childhood brain cancers, explode, all right? And they go up between 30 and 90% in the years immediately following the polio vaccine. So there is this, you know, evidence, and it's in the book, it is published, and, you know, I've gone and talked to doctors' groups and stuff like this, and I was mentioning Nixon, right?
Yeah.
The first week in office, Nixon walks into the White House and says, I'm declaring war on cancer. Well, that's interesting. You've been thinking about this long, Dick? That requires a certain amount of premeditation, okay? And one of the things we discover is Nixon comes to New Orleans during the campaign, and he goes and has lunch with Dr. Ochsner, who's in the middle of all this, all right?
Yeah.
What they're doing, who does Nixon pick to run the secret laboratory to develop the vaccine so that we can try to figure out how to get out of this mess? He gets Dr. Ochsner, who on one hand is president of the American Cancer Society, on the other hand was a stockholder in one of the labs that made the polio vaccine, who's lost two kids already to the vaccine. He is the perfect guy to run the laboratory. So what they do is they, in uptown New Orleans, there's a place called Audubon Park, and then there's the Audubon Zoo in Audubon Park, and immediately next to that is a place called the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, which was built around World War One to take care of wounded troops from Europe, okay? The ships would pull up on the river and offload the people, and this is a big facility, the campus with about 13 buildings on it, but at this point in time, it's being sort of not used very much, downgraded in the late 50s. And so they take one of the buildings in the back of this campus. It's a sort of two-and-a-half, three-story brick building, and they install the linear particle accelerator in that. And I was able to track down through some people the guy that installed it. Okay, and that's how we found out about the steel wall and all that stuff. And one of the things he said was that there was some kind of problem, and I was sent down there to uninstall it all of a sudden. When I got there, there were guys with machine guns surrounding the building, you know. And he wouldn't tell me where it was. I had to figure out where it was, but I have since talked to a number of people who have been in that building and confirmed that, I mean, one guy said, He said, I've been a building engineer and a contractor my entire career. You know, he said, I've been doing this stuff for 30 years. I've never seen electrical wiring like that. He said, you could have run a small city off of the electrical wiring in that building. Now, they had removed the particle accelerator, and they had removed the platinum pyramid that they used to split the beams. But the guy did say, he said, you know, there were no clinical access features. This was not for use on people. They were doing some kind of vaccine experiments in there. And so what they're doing is they're taking test tubes with this monkey sauce in it, okay? And the monkey sauce has got this SV40 in it, but it's also got other viruses in it because they used to cage these monkeys from Africa and Asia together in the same cages, and they got cross-infected, okay? So in the same tube with the SV40, which is kind of I'm going to say basketball-sized virus, there's a little ping-pong-sized virus in there, a little golf-ball-sized virus called SIV, the simian immunodeficiency virus, which is the ancestor virus to AIDS. These geniuses are shooting radiation through these test tubes in the hopes of mutating SIV into a benign strain like Sabin's strain in the polio vaccine so they can use it as a vaccine, okay? But they're also hitting these other things. Now, this is all happening 1959-1960 in New Orleans, which is the date of Ochsner's sensitive position signed by J. Edgar Hoover, blah, blah, blah. What happens in the early 60s changes the game. Now, New Orleans is the port of the mouth of the Mississippi River, right? The business in New Orleans, trade, okay? Just like the business in Detroit is cars, in New Orleans, it's trade. And when Castro took over Cuba, January 1st, 1959, I believe it was, what happens is there's an embargo slapped on when they realize that he's, you know, working with Russians. And that embargo costs New Orleans 25% of their trade. All right? So New Orleans is very conservative in the first place, and it's got this special hatred for Castro because he just, you know, it wasn't Castro that did the embargo. It was the Rockefellers pushing that. And the Bushes, you know, after Castro took over various oil fields and mines and stuff like that that cost those people money. And we're all sold this hatred through the media. But what happens in October of 62 is the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
We wind up with Russian nuclear missiles pointed at New Orleans. All right, and at that point in time, the CIA says, hey, you know this little project we've been helping you guys finance to develop the anti-cancer vaccine? Well, we're going to weaponize that stuff so that we can make a biological weapon to take out Fidel Castro.
Okay. So was Mary Sherman working on something to take out Castro, or was she trying to solve the problem of the polio vaccine?
Originally, she was trying to solve the problem of the polio vaccine. That was because, you know, she's published in radiation. She's also published in cancer. She's an expert in both. And she knows about the contamination of the polio vaccine, and she works for Alton Ochsner, and she is personal best friends with Sarah Stewart, who's the woman that discovers the problem, okay? They went to the University of Chicago Medical School together. Mary Sherman is in the middle of this whole thing trying to develop an anti-cancer vaccine. And my mother knew Mary Sherman. I asked her, why would Mary do this? She said, oh, Mary thought there was a chance to develop an anti-cancer vaccine and run the red tape system, she'd do it, okay?
Right. Yeah. But then, you know, when she's doing that, it's for the good thing. How did it change over to doing something like to take out Castro? I mean, wouldn't she consider that kind of more of an evil thing?
First of all, it's Russian missiles. Secondly, she works for Alton Ochsner, who is working on a CIA project. Now, one of the big things that happens is these machines cost a lot of money, tens of millions of dollars back in the 50s, okay? They're made in Boston, you know, high-voltage engineering up there in Boston, and they later moved from Boston out to Pasadena, California, built these machines. We have pictures of them in the book, okay? And the argument at the time, because we now have one of the participants in this Kill Castro project has spoken up and written her own book and stuff. We know that Mary Sherman was working with David Ferry on this project, and the rationale was the same rationale as if you could have killed Hitler soon enough, you would have prevented World War II. Okay? Well, the rationale was if you can kill Castro now, you can prevent World War III. Now, I think that's a harebrained argument, personally. I'm not in favor of it, but that is what was being told to the participants at the time. And so they started this process. They already had all the things in place.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.